Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
So we're reading from the second canto, the first chapter, text 24. And the name of the title of the chapter is The First Step in God Realization. Yes? Oh, John. That's the first step in God realization. Okay. So, do we chant the verse? We chant the verse the old-fashioned way. Okay. Okay. Vishasastasya dehoyam. Savishtas cha saviyasam. Yatredam vyajate vishvam. Bhutam bhavyam bhavachchasat. Visheshastasya dehoyam. Stavishtas cha staviyasam. Yatredam vyajate vishvam. Bhutang bhavyang bhavaschasat. Somebody else want to chant? Visheshastasya dehoyam. Savishtasya savasyasam. Yatedam vajyate vishvam. Bhutang bhavyam bhavaschasat. Visheshastasya dehoyam. Savishtasya saviyasam. Yadvedam vyajyate vishvam. Bhutam bhavyam bhavaschasat. Visheshastasya dehoyam. Savishtascha saviyasam. Yatejam vijyate vishvam. Bhutam bhavyam bhavaschasat. Visheshastasya dehoyam. Savistascha saviyasam. Yatredam vyajyate vishvam. Bhuta bhavyam bhavaschasat. Visheshastasya dehoyam. Savishtasya saviyasam. Yatredam vyajyate vishvam. Bhuta bhavyam bhavaschasat. Vishesha. Personal. Tasya. His. Deha. Body. Ayam. This. Stavishtaha. Grossly material. Cha. And. Savyasam of all matter. Yatra, wherein, idam, all these phenomena. Vyajyate, is experienced. Vishvam, universe. Bhutam, past. Bhavyam, future. Bhavat, present. Cha, and. Sat, resultant. Translation. This gigantic manifestation of the phenomenal material world as a whole is the personal body of the absolute truth, wherein the universal resultant past, present, and future of material time is experienced. Purport by Srila Prabhupada. Anything, either material or spiritual, is but an expansion of the energy of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and as stated in the Bhagavad Gita 13:13, the omnipotent Lord has his transcendental eyes, heads, and other bodily parts distributed everywhere. He can see, hear, touch, or manifest himself anywhere and everywhere, for he is present everywhere as the supersoul of all infinitesimal souls, although he has his particular abode in the absolute world. The relative world is also his phenomenal representation, because it is nothing but an expansion of his transcendental energy. Although he is in his abode, his energy is distributed everywhere, just as the sun is localized as well as expanded everywhere, since the rays of the sun, being non-different from the sun, are accepted as expansions of the sun disk. In the Vishnu Purana 1:22:52, it is said that as fire expands its rays and heat from one place, similarly the Supreme Spirit, the Personality of Godhead, expands himself by his manifold energy everywhere and anywhere. The phenomenal manifestation of the gigantic universe is only a part of his virat body. Less intelligent men cannot conceive of the transcendental, all-spiritual form of the Lord, but they are astounded by his different energies, just as the aborigines are struck with wonder by the manifestation of lightning, a gigantic mountain, or a hugely expanded banyan tree. The aborigines praise the strength of the tiger and the elephant because of their superior energy and strength. The asuras cannot recognize the existence of the Lord, although there are vivid descriptions of the Lord in the revealed scriptures. Although the Lord incarnates and exhibits his uncommon strength and energy, and although he is accepted as the Supreme Personality of Godhead by learned scholars and saints like Vyasadeva, Narada, Asita, Devala in the past, and by Arjuna in the Bhagavad Gita, as also by the Acharyas like Shankara, Ramanuja, Madhva, and Lord Sri Chaitanya in the modern age, the asuras do not accept any evidential proof from the revealed scriptures, nor do they recognize the authorities of the great Acharyas. They want to see with their own eyes at once. Therefore, they can see the gigantic body of the Lord as Virat, which will answer their challenge. And since they are accustomed to paying homage to superior material strength, like that of the tiger, elephant, and lightning, they can offer respect to the Virat Rupa. Lord Krishna, by the request of Arjuna, exhibited his Virat Rupa to the asuras. A pure devotee of the Lord, being unaccustomed to looking into such a mundane, gigantic form of the Lord, requires special vision for the purpose. The Lord therefore favored Arjuna with special vision for looking at his Virat Rupa, which is described in the 11th chapter of Bhagavad Gita. This Virat Rupa of the Lord was especially manifested not for the benefit of Arjuna, but for that unintelligent class of men who accept anyone and everyone as an incarnation of the Lord, and so mislead the general mass of people. For them, the indication is that one should ask the cheap incarnation to exhibit his Virat Rupa and thus be established as an incarnation. The Virat Rupa manifestation of the Lord is simultaneously a challenge to the atheist and a favor for the asuras, who can think of the Lord as Virat and thus gradually cleanse the dirty things from their hearts in order to become qualified to actually see the transcendental form of the Lord in the near future. This is a favor for the all-merciful Lord to the atheists and the gross materialists. Namo Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prastaya Buddhale Srimate Bhaktivedanta Swamini Chinamane Namaste Saraswati Deve Guruvani Pacharane Nivishesha Srinivari Prastachide Satarane Mukam Karate Vachalam Pangam Langayate Girim Nyachkita Tvamahan Vande Shri Guru Vidhan Vanchakalpatadubhyas Chakripa Sundibhya Vichapatitanam Pavanevyo Vaishnavevyo Namo Namaha. So, this part of the Bhagavatam is the beginning of a 10 or 12 canto, I guess 11 canto, explanation of what is someone supposed to do when they're about to die, which was Maharaj Parikit's question. And ultimately, the answer to his question is the culmination of the Bhagavatam to remember Krishna, to develop love for Krishna. But it doesn't come easy, as we all have experienced. And so it begins, the sages or Sukadeva Goswami begin by explaining this first step in God realization, as Prabhupada calls it in the chapter heading, that we begin by seeing the Lord in the things around us. It's described by Baladeva Jibhushan that the Vedas are more merciful than thousands or millions of parents. And the reason that description is given is that just like a parent will always try to facilitate its child, Prabhupada gives the example that even a blind child will be called Padmalochan by the mother, one with beautiful eyes like a lotus petal, even though the eyes don't work, because the parents see the best in the child and try to facilitate the child in any endeavor that he wants to or she wants to do. So in the same way, the Vedas, they try to facilitate everyone from wherever they are. So there are some Vedic literatures for people in the mode of ignorance, some Vedic literatures for people in the mode of passion, some Vedic literatures for people in the mode of goodness, and even some Vedic literature for people who are atheists. The literature itself, obviously, atheists would not read, or maybe they would read it in a scholarly way. But Krishna has created a facility for them to be able to see God, even despite themselves. And here it's described that that facility is what's being called here is Virat Rupa in a previous purport, pantheism, or the ability to see God in nature. And that comes on different levels, right? Because first we can see nature and we can appreciate nature as being godly or godlike or beyond our power. And then we can see nature as being God. And we can worship it, like Prabhupada talks about the Aborigines, that they worship nature as God. And then further development is that we see the material energy as a manifestation of the Supreme Lord to be used in His service, and that's the vision of the devotee. But for the atheist, as described here, the reason for this Virat Rupa is to help us understand how small we are, and really to understand how insignificant and how unable we are to control the material energy. And, you know, that's not an easy lesson to learn. It's funny, but in a kind of sad sort of way. But again and again, we see it, that the material energy devastates things, one thing after another. If you care to read the newspaper and get a headache, you can read practically on a daily basis that something is wrecked by the material nature. When I was going to San Francisco just recently, it took me 24 hours to fly from Miami to San Francisco. And the reason it took me 24 hours to fly was because there were so many storms in the Midwest that the whole airports were just a disaster, and planes were destroyed by hail that was this big, and tornadoes were ripping apart towns one after another, and people were sleeping all over the airport, and it was just a mess. So in that moment of terror, you know, or realization that, wow, look at that tornado. It's number 5, and it's coming at 275 miles an hour. And then when it leaves 5 minutes later, there's nothing but toothpicks in its wake. You know, there's a few feet wide strip of land in which everything has been removed, semis flying in the air. And everybody goes, oh, my gosh. And then they cry, and they look for their loved ones, and they look for their stuff. And then they rebuild and go about life completely forgetting that the material energy is more powerful than they are. And they start to calculate how they can fix it the next time, how they can build a building just like that Prabhupada quipped in Japan when he was talking to someone who was into construction. He said, we have buildings that are earthquake-proof. And when Prabhupada walked out of the conversation, he said, there's no such thing as an earthquake-proof building. But we try, despite ourselves, despite our constant remembrance, right? Last night we had a storm, relatively small storm, considering what I just spoke about, in Alachua, and the electricity was out for a couple of hours, and trees fell down, and it was pouring. We had a lake in front of our house that was almost a foot and a half deep. We put out buckets because we didn't know when we were going to get water. And in 10 minutes, the buckets were completely filled with water. So it was really raining hard. And when you see that like that, right, the lightning and the thunder, you can't help, especially if you have any humility whatsoever, you can't help but feel that, gosh, I'm so small. You know, I'm so insignificant. In 1 second, the whole thing could be wiped out. Everything, you know. Kalakanta Prabhu used to sing a song called "Mobile Home," and and you know, it keeps you hot. What is it? Hot in the summer and cold in the winter. And, oh Lord, please don't take my mobile home away. Yeah, living off the land. And then the refrain is, "Dear Lord, please don't take my mobile home away." And you can see, you know, so much blood, sweat, and tears putting the place together, and in a matter of seconds, it could just be flying in the air, you know. And what can you do about it? You can't do anything about it. So Krishna creates this vision for even the atheist to see, ultimately, eventually, to get it, that the material world is more powerful. I brought a little bit of a slide thing. A movie-ish thing. It's just a few seconds, minutes. Can you put it on? Okay, you can stop it there. Stop it. So it's humbling, isn't it? When you consider how small we are, that we're walking around in Gainesville, or maybe we're in, you know, somebody's in a big office or has a big education or a lot of money or a fancy car, and they think, I'm cool. You know, they're driving around in their Ferrari or their Porsche, and they're thinking, I'm cool. And then when you look at it in this perspective, or even in the perspective of that, you know, stage 5 tornado, how big are you? You're very, very small. So this lesson of smallness, this lesson of insignificance is an essential lesson to learn before one can proceed on to self-realization, into the process of self-realization. We have to be humbled in relation to the Supreme Lord. So that's why this chapter is called the first step in God realization. Because, of course, Maharaj Parikshit, he was way beyond the first step. The acharyas say that he asked these questions because he directed this conversation for us to read. The Bhagavatam is given to the people of the age of Kali. Don't forget that the sages of Namasharanya, they sat down. Does anybody remember why they sat down? Find a cure. Yeah, vaccine, something. The age of Kali is coming, and we see disaster imminent because people are lazy, misguided, unfortunate, and very prone to quarrel. We need to do something, but we don't know what to do. So let's do 1,000 celestial year sacrifice and try to mitigate the effects of the coming of the age of Kali. And in so, as a result of that sacrifice and as a result of so many other arrangements made by the Supreme Lord, past and future, the Bhagavatam is spoken. And that Bhagavatam is described as Krishna coming himself to dissipate the darkness of the age of Kali. It's the incarnation of the Supreme Lord. Where has Krishna gone in this now? I mean, he's gone, he's appeared in the Bhagavatam and in the holy name. And these incarnations of Godhead are there to help us to overcome, to get through this age. Lord Chaitanya is so kind that he made it really easy, because anything too complicated, we wouldn't be able to get it. But we can't even get that until we get this. This has to come first, this understanding of our smallness, this understanding of our insignificance. Arjuna, even on the Battle of Kurukshetra, he was, he was Krishna's devotee, so much so that when he had an option to choose the armies, to choose Krishna as a chariot driver, he chose Krishna as a chariot driver. So that was, you know, that was a sign that he really had a lot of faith in Krishna, and he really saw Krishna as his worshipable Lord. But still, he was having difficulty with this concept of blowing up his or killing his grandfather and his guru and so many relatives and so many things. And so then Krishna showed him in the 11th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, as described here in this purport, he showed him the universal form. And Arjuna could see in that one spot everything in all the material and spiritual worlds. He could see it all in one place. He could see the past, he could see the present, he could see the future, and he could see it all sitting right on his chariot. And it was mind-blowing, to quote the slideshow. It was mind-blowing. And for Arjuna, it was an aha moment. Okay, I get it. You're more important than me. You're the Supreme Personality of Godhead. I have to offer my respects to you. But in seeing Krishna that way, he became fearful. He actually became frightened, and he said, okay, I've had enough of that. Now could you fold that up and put it back where it came from and remanifest your Soumya Rupa, your beautiful form. And so for us, we don't have that loving relationship with Krishna yet. What to speak of the materialistic men who are being spoken of in this purport? They don't have that vision yet. And so they need to get it. And Krishna very mercifully gives it to them by showing them this material manifestation. It's a very difficult lesson to learn sometimes. And it's amazing when you think about it that life after life, people don't learn it. Even though they go through holocausts and storms and disasters like the tsunami in Japan, and that even their own attempt at solving problems like creating nuclear reactors backfire and create nuclear disasters, and still they don't get it. They don't really understand how insignificant and how unable they are to control the material energy. What to speak of, get the fact that there's a Supreme Lord that's above it all. Matter of fact, very often it turns them against the Supreme Personality. I'm sure you've heard the question, right? If there's a God, then why is he such a mean creep, you know, that he's giving us all this trouble? Why doesn't he make it nice for us? And there should be nice fragrances and flowers and everything. But we really need to come to the point of helplessness before we can take shelter of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So Krishna sets up this structure. And the beginning of self-realization is to be able to see the Supreme Lord in this form. And it's fun, it's actually quite amazing that we see this every single day. So it's not a matter of seeing something that we haven't seen before. It's just a matter of seeing something differently. In the Bhagavad Gita, Arjuna really just gets a change of vision. He gets new lenses with which to see what he's already seen. He already saw the cheating of the Kauravas. He saw how they cheated the Pandavas out of their kingdom. He saw how his wife was mistreated. He saw how there were so many intrigues and bad behavior on the part of the Kauravas, especially Duryodhana. He already experienced it. But yet when he came on the battlefield, he got nervous. He couldn't bring his heart to the task of killing those people. But Krishna gave him a different vision. Nothing really changed. They were still sitting on the battle. They were still in the chariot. They still had to fight. When the conch shells blew, when the discussion of Bhagavad Gita was over, then the war would start. And Arjuna was just sitting in between the two armies for, 45 minutes or so? So he didn't really, nothing really happened except that Arjuna's vision changed. So in the same way, our vision needs to change. And when the vision changes, then the very same things that you're looking at daily, every day, every day, every day, every day, they take on a new character, a new realization, a new way of giving us lessons. And we start to see things very differently than other people. I think I might have mentioned this to you, but it's worth saying again. When I was in the hospital in North Florida, next door to me, there was a Bhagavatam class going on. And there was an old lady. She was 93 or 4 years old. And she was engaged or dating to dating a 97-year-old man. So that man, he was walking with a walker, and she was in a bed being diagnosed with some terminal situation, because when you're 93, everything is terminal. And and yet they were speaking to each other as if they were high school kids. You know, I'd hear them on the phone because there was nothing but a curtain between me and her. We were just very close to each other. And she was saying, you know, darling, I love you. I just wait for the moments when you call me. And I look forward so much to seeing you. When are you going to come tomorrow? Will you be able to be here? And, you know, he would come in sometime in the afternoon with his walker, barely able to walk. And he would say, darling, it's so wonderful to see you again. Meanwhile, she's laying in bed. She's got tubes all over herself. She's, you know. So what kind of vision is that? Right? What kind of glasses do you have to have on? What kind of 3D spectacles do you need to be able to see the world in that way? And then from my perspective, I'm sitting there, and all the nurses also, even though they don't know anything about Krishna, at least some of them didn't, because Glani Nashina was my nurse, and she's an initiated devotee, but they were laughing. It was like the talk of the hospital, that these two people had been boyfriend and girlfriend in before, and they had reconnected when they were in their 70s. But she was married to somebody else, and he was married to somebody else. So they patiently waited for their present spouses to pass away, and then they reestablished their relationship. Huh? Their eternal relationship, yes. They reestablished their eternal relationship. So how powerful is the covering energy of the Supreme Personality of God? How powerful is it that we can think like that we can go like that? And to me, who, because I met Srila Prabhupada and I'm reading a little bit of the Bhagavatam and I have some 43 years behind me of chanting Hare Krishna, I saw it in a completely different way. It made me very sad. When Prabhupada was driving by the golf course and he saw all the old men playing golf, Prabhupada cried. He cried. He thought, what a waste of the human form of life. Here are these people that are at the age when they should be perfecting their spiritual life, and they're hitting a ball into a hole. And they're spending hundreds of dollars to do it every day, or is whenever they get a chance, right? In Edmonton, I was just visiting my daughter in Edmonton, Alberta, which is 30 degrees below zero 6 months out of the year. And then 3 months out of the year, it's called summer, and it gets to be about 75 degrees. So everyone, when the warm weather comes, everyone runs outside because they're inside all the time, right? They have a mall, a 5-mile square mall. It's the biggest mall in North America. And in that mall, there's like an ocean. They've created this water that has waves. It's like an ocean. It's a salt water. I guess it's a swimming pool by definition, but it has waves. And it's inside the mall. And inside the mall is a golf course. And inside the mall is whatever you want to do because you can't do it outside most of the year. So when the sun actually comes out, then everyone runs outside to play golf. Right? So my son-in-law also, one of the wiser people, was outside also trying to play golf. So we went outside and came back within an hour. And we asked, well, why did you come back in an hour so fast? You couldn't have played a game in that. The mosquitoes were so bad. The mosquitoes were so bad, we couldn't stay outside. It was terrible. We couldn't even concentrate. We were just like, you know, so they had to cancel their game. So that even the mosquitoes are waiting for the weather to change. Right? When can I come out? When can come? And even though we go through this, even though the weather is hellish, it's freezing, freezing cold, and, you know, no one really should live there. It's not fit for human habitation. Prabhupada called what, Switzerland or Switzerland, St. Helens. They were talking about, yeah, they went to take him to this ski resort. It was called St. Helens. And it was very fancy, and rich people go there, and they go skiing, and they stayed at a five-star hotel. And Prabhupada couldn't walk outside. It was freezing cold, and it was, he called it St. Helens. And he chanted his rounds. He did his japa walk back and forth in the hotel lobby. And the light was timed so it would go off and on and off and on. And Shrutikirti kept pressing the button so that the light would go on. Because every time it shut off, Prabhupada was still pacing, so he would turn it on again. So St. Helish, the material world is St. Helish. And somehow or the other, we live in it and we think it's great. No matter where we are. The people who are in Edmonton think Edmonton is great. They do. They're very patriotic. And they think Edmonton is great. Why? Who knows? And this old lady and this old man, they think each other is great. And that they're going to be together and be happy for at least another 3 years until one of them leaves the planet. And we go through our lives like this again and again. So the Bhagavatam begins this God realization staircase, so to speak, with this realization that we are very, very small. We are very, very insignificant. We have no power, just like you saw there, that from our perspective we think Earth is very big, and then all of a sudden we look in the perspective of other planets and we see the Earth getting smaller and smaller, and then we look in the perspective of the Sun and you can't even see the Earth. The Earth disappears, literally disappears. And then you think the Sun is so big, but when then you look other suns in other universes and all of a sudden the Sun disappears. The sun becomes irrelevant, so small, and yet we're totally dependent on it. We can't do anything without the sun. Krishna says, I'm the heat and the light of the sun. So we need to get this realization, and we need to give it to others, because this realization is the beginning. Understanding that I don't know everything, that everything is not within my power, that I cannot change things significantly is the beginning point of the journey back to Godhead. Just think, Mother Jasoda looked into Krishna's mouth and saw the entire universe. Just like Arjuna saw it on the chariot, Mother Jasoda saw it in the mouth of this baby, this little boy. He opened his mouth. You've been eating dirt. Have not. Have too. I'm gonna look in your mouth and see if you've been eating dirt. And in his mouth, she saw the whole universe. She tried to bind him with ropes, but she couldn't bind him. No matter how many ropes she took, hundreds and hundreds, it's described that she took all the ropes from all the village and she tied them all together and they wouldn't go around the waist of this little child until he sanctioned her. Until he gave her permission. Okay, Mom, you've tried hard enough. Your hair is falling out. You're exhausted. You're sweating. You're tired. I'll let you tie me. Because you love me so much, I'll let you tie me. And that truly is the only way that we can conquer over the material energy. I don't know how many of you were at the Sunday Feast Lecture, not this week, but last week. I spoke about trees. And how trees, you know, everybody's so into this green stuff, that everything should be green. But the real element that's necessary to make things green or to make things ecologically sustainable is this consciousness, or as it puts it in the Sri Shripanishad, the Ishavasya consciousness, the understanding that nothing is ours and that we have control over nothing, that everything is the Supreme Lord's, and that we only are entitled to a very small fraction of it as our own. And if we just take what we need, not what we want, but what we need, then there'll be enough of everything to go around. There'll be enough of everything. So really, when we look at the material world, we see this, what's green now, is it's a market, marketing strategy. You know, it's not really green. There's a factory necessary to make all those green cups that are changing the world one cup at a time. That's what they say on them, the eco cups, if you look at them, and say, they say making a difference one cup at a time. So are they making a difference, really? They cost more, so people have to work harder to get them. You can go bankrupt buying ecological stuff, right? Because ecological stuff costs more than anything else. So the whole thing is a ploy. And it's still creating factories. It's still polluting rivers. It's still polluting the air. It's not sustainable. The only sustainable way of life is understanding the Ishavasya principle, that everything is owned and operated by the Lord, and that we are entitled to a very small amount, just what we need. And we don't really need much. We don't really need much. We were talking in our little training program over at the ashram about the simplicity of ashram life. And the girls were saying that it's so easy to be Krishna conscious. We get up in the morning, we chant our rounds, we go to the temple, we see Radha Shyam, we come home, prasadam is there, right? The laundry facility is right there, the clothesline. One girl is coming from New York, she said, boy, it's so nice to just be able to hang your clothes on the line and take them down. It's great. So, and then there's the association of devotees. You all have the association of devotees. When you come home, there's people who are Krishna conscious, right? And your meals are taken care of. You don't have to worry. All you have to do is be here on time. And then everybody is going to sleep at a really relatively decent hour, so that in the morning everyone can get up. And the whole lifestyle revolves around the opportunity to take up Krishna consciousness. But even though we look at it and we say, this is so easy, it's great, still, in the back of our mind, we're thinking, I really want to make my life more complicated. I need a few children, I need a husband, I need a wife, I need a house, I need a car, the list goes on and on and on and on. And one thing that came out very clearly, especially Amrita Kaili had some very strong realization about this, was when we did the Japa retreat out in Luther Springs, that some of the people who came were young women who had been in our ashram before. And they had lived there for their whole high school and some of their college career. And then they went to school and they got a job, and some of them got married and they have children. And now they were saying that they hadn't chanted their rounds in several years. Some of them. They were finding it so difficult to get through the day, to figure out how to put it all together. And it was such a relief for them. They were so grateful for the opportunity to just be there and have the prasadam served right on time, and the ability to get up and have a program with everybody. And Amrita Kaili said, isn't there some way to do both at the same time, to make your life complicated and to keep it simple? Well, that's in a way, that's our job. That's what we call balance. Right? That everybody talks about balance, how we have to balance the material and spiritual. That's what balance is. Balance is how to make it just complicated enough so that you learn the lessons you need to learn, and keep it simple enough so that you can keep practicing Krishna consciousness so you can learn the lessons that you need to learn. So you need to, the main thing is to keep the main thing the main thing. Right? That's the main thing. Is that you have to be able to keep Krishna in the center. And so you can build your complicated universe around Krishna, but if somehow it becomes too big and it obliterates the Supreme Personality of Godhead, then you're in trouble. And then you can't see the forest for the trees. So this first step in God realization, to see Krishna in the trees, is really important. Because that's the fundamental thing that's always around you. It's always there. And if you have the vision to be able to see Krishna in the trees and in the other aspects of nature, you'll never be able to forget Krishna. Because no matter where you are, there's going to be that Virat Rupa there. So that's why this is the fundamental building block of self-realization. The ability to see the Supreme Lord in everything around you and never forget it. Remember that primary principle of devotional service, which everything else is a servant to? Always remember Krishna and never forget him. So one way to remember Krishna, an easy way, is to see him in the world around you. And no matter how big you build your world, don't forget to see Krishna there. Because if you forget to see Krishna there, then you're in trouble. And it may be years, it may be years, it may be years before, again, you get that vision, again, that you pick up and you remember, oh, yeah, there's Krishna. And that time, if you're lucky, you're still alive when you remember. But if you're not lucky, there may be a few lifetimes in between the time when you remembered him and the time you remember him again. Questions? We'll stop there. Yeah. Let's get a microphone.
I was thinking about the definition of Kanishtadhikari.
Yes.
Who sees Krishna only in the temple.
Mm-hmm.
And then slowly one gradually increase in Krishna consciousness, he can mm-hmm. see Krishna everywhere. But here, interestingly, here in Bhagavatam, the description starts with Krishna seeing everywhere. Am I confusing something?
Well, it's confusing something because this vision here, this pantheistic vision, doesn't really see Krishna as the Supreme Personality of Godhead anywhere. They see something great. And maybe they even call it God, but it's in the trees, it's in the power of nature. They don't really see Krishna playing a flute, you know, that personality of Godhead anywhere. They haven't come to the stage yet of recognizing the personality of Godhead as a separate entity outside of his material manifestation of trees and grass and, you know, tornadoes and cyclones and all those things. They see God as those things. You see the difference? The gross materialist, the atheist, they don't see God anywhere. They don't see anything as greater than themselves. So the power of the material energy at least allows them to see that they're not so great after all. That this big, huge, multi-million dollar house they built of their hard work can be obliterated in a matter of seconds by a power far greater than theirs. And they can't do anything about it, absolutely nothing. They're helpless. So at least that gives them a sense of some humility there. You know, they feel, even if it's just for a few months until they build a new one, they feel that sense of helplessness that I really, there's a power out there that's greater than me. That's what this Bhagavatam verse is talking about. Then that realization moves on to being, to having, like Prabhupada says, the reverence of the aborigines, where you actually see God in nature. You see that as the manifestation of God, something all-powerful, all-knowing, whatever. And then when you come to understand that God is separate, this is just his energy. It's like, you know, the difference between thinking the thunderbolt is the essence and then seeing Indra wielding the thunderbolt, then you see the thunderbolt as a weapon of somebody. So now there's a person involved. That's when you get to Kanishta. And the Kanishta Adhikari sees that person confined to the altar, to the temple room. And he doesn't see them. He doesn't see him in everyone's heart or in every living entity. Is that okay? Yes, and then but sees them differently. He doesn't see Krishna everywhere in the sense that he sees Krishna everywhere here. He sees Krishna's energies everywhere, that Krishna is involved everywhere, that he's he's in control everywhere, but at the same time he exists separately. He has a place in the Supreme Personality of Godhead, has an address, a phone number. Prabhupada said, you know, there's a joke about somebody who a devotee who goes to see the Pope, and he walks into the Vatican and the Pope is on the phone. So he says, who are you talking to? He says, I'm talking to God. Just wait a minute. I have some important things to discuss. So he's talking and talking, and then the devotee says, oh, can I speak to him too? He says, sure. So he gets on the phone and talks for a few minutes, and then when it's over, someone presents him with a bill for like 900 euro. He says, wow, it's really expensive. He says, well, it's long distance. So then the devotee goes to Vrindavan, and the Pope is visiting Vrindavan. So the Pope comes to Vrindavan, and he goes to see the devotee, and he comes in. The devotee's talking to God on the phone. So he says, oh, who are you talking to? I'm talking to God. Wait a minute, I have some things to discuss with him. So he's talking to God, and then the Pope says, well, can I speak to him too? He says, sure. So he talks, and then he gives him the bill for 10 rupees. He says, wow, it's so cheap. He says, it's a local call. So God has his address, he has his phone number, Prabhupada said, if you ask us, we'll tell you. We'll give you God, we'll give you all the information you need. We know who his mother is, we know who his father is, we know his village, we know who his relatives were, what his pets' names are. We know everything about the Supreme Personality of Godhead if you want to know it. But most people don't think of God that way. And so the Uttama Adhikari has that vision. And even in the Majjhima Adhikari, to some extent, begins to understand that the Supreme Personality of Godhead is everywhere. His energies are everywhere, but he exists and has his pastimes separately. Okay? Anybody else? That it? All my question askers are not here.
I just wanted to like add, not philosophical thing, but all those red giants we saw. All those big stars we saw. They will burn out and will shrink to the size of Earth or Jupiter.
Yeah, but probably not within a few million lifetimes. So, you know, yeah, they will burn out and they will shrink. Or at least that's what they think, or that's what they say. And one can assume also that more will be created, you know, because it's not finite. It's infinite. Even the material world, which is relatively finite compared to the spiritual world, still within the material sphere, it's ever being created. It's not a stagnant thing. So, yes.
Sometimes when I hear or read about Krishna and his personality or Lord Chaitanya's pastimes or something like that, I find like my faith becomes firmer in Krishna. But then other times I read it and I start having doubts and I wonder like, well, how could that really happen? And I mean, what do you think the root of this inconsistency is?
Well, Krishna's pastimes are, to use the colloquial expression, pretty far out. And the Bhagavatam even is pretty far out. And even the Bhagavad Gita in certain places is pretty far out. I mean, the sense that when you consider that Arjuna was sitting on the chariot and he could see, you know, all of a sudden Krishna got bigger and bigger and bigger and manifested millions of heads and fire coming out. So, you know, okay, you see it in sci-fi movies, but as far as understanding it or accepting it as reality, it's a stretch for our mundane consciousness. But the reality that God can create a tornado and wipe out 20 towns in 24 hours is a reality. You can read it on the newspaper, in the newspaper. So it must be true if you can read it in the newspaper. So black and white, right? So we have to... That's why we're asked to go into Krishna, into the philosophy of Krishna consciousness gradually. Because your faith has to build, by sadhu sangha, associating with devotees, by, anartha nivritti, by cleaning the heart of impurities, by bhajanakriya, by practicing devotional service. You become more able to see things clearly and to accept that, just like here, this, as you look at this, I remember once, my mother is a city slicker. My mother isn't on the planet anymore. But my mother, when she was a city slicker. She was born in New York, moved to L.A., and those are the only two places she ever lived. So once she came to visit us at the farm here in Alachua, but it was years and years and years ago. And she was trying to walk in her high heels on the sand, and, she was getting stuck everywhere. And then there was a field of carrots, and I walked over to the field, and I pulled out a carrot from the ground. And she was like, wow, is that how carrots grow? I had a girl in Radhamanjari, when she was 12, she asked me, how does spaghetti grow? So, you know, even these things, which to us is so silly, you know, how does a carrot grow? How does spaghetti grow? These are silly, but to some people, it's not silly. To some people, they have so little understanding of how the material world works that even the fact that a carrot grows underground and can be pulled out orange out of the earth is amazing. It's amazing. It's shocking. So as we see that there are different dimensions to our ability to perceive things, just like here, this goes on, by the way, this video. I didn't show you the whole thing. The whole thing is about 16, 18 minutes long. But it goes on to explain how wonderful it is that even though I'm so tiny, I mean, compared to the Earth, to the Sun, the Jupiter, blah, 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 you know, and here I am, this speck. And Prabhupada came here, and by his teaching, he's giving me the ability to go back to the spiritual world, which this whole thing that we looked at is only one quarter of a little corner of that whole creation. So, and Prabhupada's giving me the key to walk into there. And I have a place in that place. I have a spot there saved for me where I can go back when I leave this material world. So that's even more amazing than all the other amazing stuff. So as we build our faith, then the doubts go away. But they don't go away quickly, and they're not even supposed to go away quickly. We ask questions, we keep chanting, we keep our association strong, so our faith remains strong, even though we have doubts. Arjuna had doubts. So the doubts are okay as long as you are open to the answers. And as you begin to see that you don't really see everything. See, the reason you have doubts is because you're still, even though you intellectually don't feel this way, practically, you're convinced that what you see with your senses and what you experience with your senses is reality. And that's not true. And you know it's not true, but still there's that underlying, you know, show me, kind of. We're all from Missouri in the ultimate sense of the word. So gradually as you advance, that becomes further and further back. That moves away from the front of your consciousness, and you're more open to see things that you can't see with your eyes. Because all the time you see things that you can't see with your eyes, but you just don't recognize it. And so you become more able to recognize it, and then far out things aren't really so far out anymore. Even old age does that to you on the material level.
I feel kind of like, I don't know what the word is, I'm like hovering between two places or something, because it's like, I understand that what I see in the material world isn't real. I understand that more than I understand that, you know, all of these pastimes of Krishna are real. So it's like,
yeah, but it's a progression. Like, this is the first step in God realization. It's not the last step. The last step is nine cantos away. So there's a lot of learning to do. You know, there's a lot of purification to do, and there's a lot of realizations to be had. And as you open up new dimensions, as you chant, just chanting one good round or one good set of mantras or one good Krishna or trying to chant one good mantra opens up doors. What to speak of when we get a taste for the holy name and there's actually some entrance into the pastimes of Krishna, then things open up and all of a sudden things become very clear. We can see them. So, and ultimately, Krishna says that realization comes from him within our heart, that he opens it up. So we have to be patient. That's why patience and conviction of success are two of the essential ingredients to achieving pure devotional service.